sack on a safety blitz by Craig Butler. Aggressive defense strikes, but there's a flag at the 40-yard line. Intercepted. Pitoff is going back the other way. John Boyette, the safety's got it. And Boyette goes out of bounds at the 45. Hamilton is turned away again.
Welcome to Podski Wee Wee. I'm Josh Smith.
And I'm Mike Graham.
Are you going to Grey Cup this year?
Unfortunately, I am not.
Yeah, I'm not either. But a friend of ours, a fantasy league mate, and just a friend of the show, Joe Pritchard. Everyone knows him on Twitter as USFL Tecmo. He sent me a message asking if I wouldn't mind plugging a little event that will be taking place Grey Cup weekend. It's the CFL Fans Fight Cancer event. It will be held at Garbanzo's Pizza Pub on Saturday, November 28th from 11 to 2. Chris Walby, the Hall of Famer and former, was he a color commentator, I believe, on CBS?
He was.
He had the Walby Warriors and all that stuff. He will be the MC of the event, so that's pretty cool. The CFL Fans Fight Cancer group has teamed up with the CFL Alumni Association, so it's just a great event. The proceeds will go to the Never Alone Foundation, which was created by Lyle Bauer, who, if I'm not mistaken, used to run the Winnipeg Blue Bombers. So it's a great event. You and I won't be going to Grey Cup, so we won't be able to attend, but I hope anyone out there that's listening that is going to Grey Cup stops by. 11 to 2 in the afternoon is not really all that big of a commitment. And get to meet Chris Walby. That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, that's a big get to get him to run the event. So yeah, go check it out.
So there's no real good way to go from talking about cancer into talking about football, but we're going to do it anyway. The Ticats on Sunday had a golden opportunity to put a stranglehold on their first place aspirations. And to put it mildly, they crapped the bed. They lost 12-6 at home to the Ottawa Redblacks and have basically ceded control of the East Division to Ottawa, which is not something anyone thought they'd be saying with 1 week left in the CFL season. But to me, this comes down to mistakes and missed opportunities. The Ticats just kept shooting themselves in the foot at every possible turn. Just a really poorly played game by the Ticats.
Yeah, it was ugly out there. I mean, it just... right from the start, you know, they couldn't get it going on offense. You know, they give up a field goal to Ottawa early on, and then they get them the punt, and Neil King roughs the kicker, and then they get the ball back. They don't score a touchdown off it, but they get another field goal. And it was just, Ottawa had the ball pretty much the whole first quarter, and it was just dominated by Ottawa early on. Throughout the game, it kind of balanced out. The defense really stepped up for the Ticats, but that was one of the bright spots in this game. The defense really kept the Ticats in the game, but the offense just couldn't get the ball rolling.
I was saying to myself during the game, with how poorly the offense was playing, that the defense was going to have to score. And early on, they had an opportunity, and again, another missed chance. The ball hits Clichon Page right in the hands, and from the looks of it, he probably would have taken it to the house. There was a couple of Red Blacks there. One, I believe, was Chris Williams, but he had lost the ball, so he was probably not going to make a play on it. And the other Red Black was going to be blocked by, I believe, Brandon Stewart, and it was clean sailing. And again, would have changed the game. Speaking of Brandon Stewart, he had a beautiful interception that he took to the house. Everyone's going crazy. You're thinking, holy crap, they're as poorly as they played, they're going to win this game. Flag on the play, comes back, and the Ticats end up getting nothing for it. Just too many chances that they had and too many blown opportunities. Two red zone interceptions by Jeff Matthews. Come on. There's 6 points at least right there. That tie game goes to overtime. You never know what can happen. Just terrible.
Yeah, to get that close to the end zone and then turn over the ball is unacceptable. We've been talking a lot about how we still believe in this team, and it's been taken out of me a bit, I think, after this game. It's just such a poor performance in such a big game. I'm not sure if this team has what it takes to get back to the Grey Cup, let alone win the Grey Cup. So I'm not saying it's impossible, but the way that the offense is performing right now, it's tough for me to see them beating either Ottawa or Toronto. Yeah, Toronto and Ottawa, I don't have the defense that Hamilton has, but if they can't score points on offense, then they're in big trouble.
I'm with you 100%. The defense can't pick shutouts every week. I think we talked about this back when Caleros was hurt. We said the defense was going to have to step up for this team to win. They stepped up. You allow four field goals, three of which came in the first quarter. They allowed 3 points over the game's final 45 minutes, and the Ticats still could not get the win. This defense can only do so much. The offense has got to do something, anything. And if they would have had even a mediocre performance on Sunday, they would have won this game. But they were just horrendous. The offensive line was not great. One of our keys going into the game last week that we talked about was them keeping the pressure off Jeff Matthews. Six sacks? Just indescribable. You cannot have that. You just cannot allow the pass rushers to get there six times in the game. Now, I'm not going to put the blame entirely on the offensive line because there were plenty of instances where Matthews just held onto the ball too long. But regardless, you cannot allow a ferocious defense like Ottawa to get six sacks. You're not going to win very many football games doing that.
And, why aren't they hitting the ball off to Gable more? I mean, it takes so much pressure off of Matthews if Gable gets more carries. I mean, I think he had seven carries in this game, which is just unacceptable. This guy's a talented back. He's one of the best runners in the league, in my opinion, and I'm sure in your opinion. So, you got to give him the ball. You got to give him a chance to make some yards. You got to give him a chance to contribute to this offense. Matthews isn't Claros. He can't throw the ball on every play. He has to be able to hand off to the running back once in a while. So seven handoffs to Gable is just not going to do it.
No, it's not. They did run the ball somewhat effectively, but it was with Terrell Sinkfield and Brandon Banks. Sinkfield even lined up in the backfield as a running back on a couple of plays. You have CJ Gable, you might as well use him. He doesn't look to be hurt anymore. He's running with purpose. He had a couple nice runs against Ottawa. I just don't... I'm flummoxed as to why they are not relying on a run game. Before last week, and we kind of gave them a pass last week for not running the football a bunch because the game got out of hand early and you have to throw to pick up chunk yardage to make up the point differential. But prior to last week, the three games previous to that, before CJ Gable came back from injury, the Ticats had run the ball more than any team in the league. Now all of a sudden CJ Gable comes back and you're like, well, we don't need the running game anymore. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous.
I totally agree. And it's just frustrating right now. They need to go back to the drawing board and figure something out for next week because, they play Ottawa next week again, as we all know, and they have to win by at least seven to claim first place. So they need a better strategy going into next week.
Yeah, if they play anywhere close to the way they played on Sunday, they're not going into Ottawa and getting a win. It just won't happen.
It's kind of confused to why they didn't throw a Hail Mary at the end of on the last play of the game, too. I don't know. Like, it was just an intermediate pass, like a 15, 20 yards, and then, he just got tackled. I believe they were in Ottawa's territory or around the 50-yard line. I don't know why they didn't, just toss it up, see what happens.
They were at the 40. They were at Ottawa's 40.
Yeah.
Two things that I would say is that Ja'Cory Harris had come in for Jeff Matthews at that point, and he has seen such limited action. Although, here's the play call, throw it up into the end zone isn't exactly something you really need to practice. It's just throw it up in the end zone. Ottawa had shifted all their DBs back there, but still, you take the shot. Throwing it down at the 25 does nothing, especially because then Tasker catches it and they don't even bother. They didn't set up a lateral play or anything, so it was just kind of a wasted play. The only thing I could think of is that despite Ja'Cory Harris having a somewhat strong arm, they were going into the wind, so maybe they were thinking he's not going to be able to get it to the end zone. I don't know, but it was just a really poorly designed and poorly executed play.
Yeah, I just didn't understand it, but toss it up there, see if someone can bring it down, or you get pass interference. But
hey, I think teams should do that going into. I hate when teams take a knee at the half when they're around midfield, because throw the ball up there. Like you said, maybe you get a pass interference call and you get some points out of it, or maybe you get another shot at the end zone. I don't like this. Like it almost looked like they had given up, and I kind of understand it. This was a two-game total point series, so winning this game is nice, but it's not. Doesn't mean the Ticats are eliminated from the first place conversation. They can still get first place next week if they win by six or more. It was just a frustrating game to watch, and maybe my mind's kind of scattered. It was just terrible.
Wouldn't it be crazy if Hamilton dropped down to third place in the East? I mean,
they can't.
What's that?
They can't drop to third.
I thought the Argos can still get a home playoff state.
Nope. With their loss to BC last week, the Argos can only get 10 wins.
Right.
They could. If they would have won out, they could have. But
they
dropped the ball big time against the Lions at home. So that all ended. Right. Yeah, that pretty much ended any hopes that they. Actually, no, not pretty much. That ended any hopes they had of hosting a playoff game. So, no, the Ticats are getting a home game, be it the 15th or the 23rd. That's all that has to be decided.
All right, well, that's good then.
But like you said, the way they're playing right now, I don't care if they're at home. They don't look like they're good enough to win a playoff game, let alone two. So I don't think it's going to matter if they continue to play this poorly.
Yeah, it's just Austin said that he was, has to think about who might start next week, even if Matthews is healthy. So, you bring in Harris, and then you got another new quarterback in there. I don't like the idea of that. Then you got Mazzoli in third string. He's had his chance. So it's just not a good situation in Hamilton right now, and I'm kind of worried about a one and out in the playoffs.
Yeah, just the season had so much promise earlier. We all got depressed and down when Caleros got hurt, obviously, but I really envisioned the season going down the tubes like this. Maybe they turn it around, maybe they find a way to get to the Grey Cup, but even if they do, I'm hard-pressed to see this team hoist the trophy. It doesn't look like it's going to be our year this year. I'm not losing faith. I'm not abandoning the team. I'm going to cheer as hard as I ever have, but it's tough not to get down after a performance like we saw on Sunday.
Yeah, and just the way this team was playing earlier in the year, I really thought that this is the year, and then disaster strikes late in the summer against Edmonton. So yeah, I'm not giving up either, but my confidence took a big hit yesterday.
So the big talking point after this game was a first quarter hit that Simone Lawrence laid on Henry Burris. Now, I'm not sure if you had a chance to hear Burris's comments at halftime of the game, but he essentially said that going low on a quarterback or whomever is worse than using performance-enhancing drugs. So I've been tweeting out my opinion on this. I'd like to get your opinion on the Lawrence hit on Burris, and then I will go into a tirade.
I understand that he's upset. He doesn't want to get hurt. Obviously, no one wants to get hurt, quarterback or running back or defensive back or whatever. But that's just a silly comment. Using steroids is cheating. And the Westerman hit on him was low. Yes, that was, I understand he was pissed off about that. But this morning, Lawrence, he was out of the pocket. He was running around. He's a normal player out there. Quarterbacks get special treatment because they're really important to the game. But I didn't think the hit was illegal. I thought it was above the knee. At first glance, it looked bad. It looked like he went low. But then when you see the replays, it wasn't a legal hit. So Burris needs to calm down with that stuff. Okay, he's just upset because he had a couple low hits in the game against Winnipeg. So he's just losing his shit. He needs to calm down with that stuff.
Let's call a spade here. Henry Burris has been a whiner for flags pretty much his entire career. That's not in any way meant to disparage the guy, but he's always looking for a flag. He looks for a flag when someone looks at him cross. He doesn't like when guys breathe on him. And I understand he's a quarterback and most quarterbacks are like that, but I don't see a guy like Ricky Ray. I don't see a guy like Mike Riley. I rarely even see Zach Caleros. And all these guys get hit as well. Every quarterback in the league gets hit, but you don't see these guys whine the way Burris does. I lost a ton of respect for Henry Burris when he made the comment about performance-enhancing drugs. Are you a complete idiot? Think about what you're saying before you say it. He's out there talking about how hits like that can take him out of the game and then he can't feed his family. We sat around here and listened to people make fun of Jasper Simmons' agent when he came out and said, Simmons not playing for the Stamps means he can't feed his family. Burris is not losing a game check if he gets hurt, and he's a 40-year-old quarterback, so his career's coming to an end soon as it is. The injury wasn't going, the hit was not going to end his career. It's insane that he can come out with comments like this. And like you said, he had left the pocket. He was running. Hitting a runner low is standard. Here's the thing. You hit him high. Simone Lawrence goes in high and grazes his helmet. He gets a 15-yard flag. You can't hit quarterbacks anywhere. So you can't hit him in the thigh or the hip. Now you can't hit him in the head. Where are you supposed to hit him? You are allowed to hit them if he's running as low as you want. And in the Eskimos game against Montreal, I saw not the same play, but a very similar play. Mike Riley scrambles out of the pocket, and he throws it and essentially jumps, and a Montreal defender hits him low and knocks him on his ass. I didn't see Eskimos fans crying about a low hit on Mike Riley, who has dealt with knee injuries for almost his entire career. He was out earlier this year with a knee injury on a low hit. And you didn't hear Eskimos fans complaining. I didn't see Mike Riley get up and start calling for a flag. I didn't see a halftime interview with Riley or a post-game interview with Riley talking about how, the Montreal player is trying to end my career. I'm just sick of Burris's bitching, and I'm just sick of the guy. I'm over him.
Yeah, it really adds fuel to the fire for this rivalry. Maybe a new rivalries building in the East between Ottawa and Hamilton going forward. Burrs could be around for a couple more years. You never know. So the whole thing is just ludicrous. I don't, like I said before, I didn't think it was a dirty hit. It's not a illegal hit. So, you know, he needs to just settle down and, you know, just play his game. They're going to get hit if you're running around like that. So you're just a normal player once you're out of the pocket. So everyone gets hit low. So he just needs to take a chill pill.
I honestly think the only reason we are even discussing this is because of the hit last week by Westerman.
Yeah.
If Burris isn't walking into this game with an injured knee, this is, yeah, maybe he's still ranting and raving and making a fool of himself, but we're not discussing this nearly a day later to the extent that we are. It's, oh yeah, okay, hit him low. Maybe he shouldn't do that. Let's move on. So we'll touch on our bold predictions. Obviously, with the Ticats managing to score no touchdowns, our bold predictions were hilariously wrong. You had Gable at 75-plus rushing and a TD and 50-plus receiving and a touchdown. He had 7 carries for 27 yards, 1 catch for 5 yards, and 0 touchdowns. So that's wrong. Mine looks even worse because Brandon Banks, I said, would score 4 total TDs over the next 2 weeks, and he didn't score any in this game, and I cannot see him scoring 4 next week, so I'm pretty much already chalking that up as a wrong selection. So
that would be an game for the ages if he did, but he was more involved with the offense, I will say that.
He was much more involved in the offense. He was their second leading pass catcher. He had 6 catches, and he had a couple of carries. I really liked seeing him more involved in the offense in this game.
Yeah, I think he's a better receiver than people think.
Yeah, I think so too. I just don't think he gets the opportunities because the team has so many receivers. Let's be honest. I'm not going to go crazy and say that they have an all-star crew of receivers, but they have a really good receiving unit. So Banks isn't necessarily needed on offense, but he does strike fear in opposing defenses when he's out there because he can take the top off a defense at any time. Just having him out there, even if it's for 20 or so plays a game, can really help the offense.
Yeah, in the running game and through the air. So hopefully he gets his touches in the offense in the last game and then going into the playoffs.
So there is a little Ticat news to discuss this week. The first happened last week and came about after we finished recording the show. Surprise, surprise. Donald Washington was released. There was a bunch of releases by the Ticats, and Washington was the biggest name among them. This one really surprised me because I thought when Washington was in there, he played fantastically.
Yeah, I thought so as well. You know, he got in a couple games earlier in the season and really stood out. So I guess maybe it's just a numbers game. You know, they have a lot of DBs that are talented guys. So I don't know. They seem to find ways to sneak people on the injured list when they're not injured or put them on the practice roster. So I was very surprised about this. And I'm kind of surprised he hasn't been signed yet because he's a really talented dude.
I would go so far as to say he was Hamilton's best short side corner this season. Rico Murray played there a little bit and didn't really do much. I'm blanking on who else has played that position so far this year, but I really liked Donald Washington there, and this is a bit of a head-scratcher to me. Maybe it's a numbers game thing. I just don't understand why you would let this guy go.
Yeah, he's a young guy. He hits hard, like you said in a previous episode. So
he's got those taped fingers. That means he's gonna knock some heads.
Yeah, he seems to be a good cover guy. So yeah, I don't know why they did it. I'm sure there's a reason, you know, but it's tough to see him just let go like that.
So I am a voter for the CFL Player Awards, or at least I got to vote on the Ticat Player Awards. This is the first time I've ever done it. My opinion actually means something. This can help decide who gets the Player Awards for the Ticats, which I'm not going to lie to you. When I got the ballot in my email, I was pretty stoked. I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, man.
So the ballots were due at midnight on November 1st. I got them in a little earlier. I wrote a piece about it on 3 Down Nation about who I chose and why. So I thought we could play a little game here. I'll say who I picked for the awards. You can say who you picked would pick for the awards, and we can go a little back and forth on it. How about that?
That sounds good.
We'll finish with MOP. We'll start with Most Outstanding Special Teams Player. So this, to me, came down to two guys, Brandon Banks and Justin Medlock. Both have had really good seasons. Banks has scored 4 touchdowns on returns, the most of any player in the league, so I went with Banks.
I got to go with Banks as well. Medlock, you know, Medlock's just so consistent all the time, so, you know, he would have been a good nominee for sure, but you got to go with Banks.
Yeah, interesting thing I should mention, though, is you do get 2 choices. You get a first choice and a second choice. So I'm guessing there's a point system, or I'm not sure how they really decide it, but you get to pick your first selection and a second selection. selection. So obviously for that, my first pick was Banks and my second was Medlock. But yeah, it's just, I know he hasn't played particularly well recently, Brandon Banks, that is, but it's hard not to go with the guy who might be the most dangerous special teams player in the league. Stephon Logan has been really good in Montreal this year, and there's a ton of talented returners out there, but Brandon Banks strikes fear into the hearts of defenses or opposing special teams units, like maybe not since Chris Williams a few years back.
You got to go with Banks. Banks, Logan, even at his advanced age, you know, he's 34 years old, he's still tearing it up. And a newcomer for the BC Lions, Chris Rainey, he is a dangerous guy. You know, every time he touches the ball on punt returns, you kind of hold your breath because he kind of has that same feel as Banks. You know, every time he touches the ball, he could take it back.
So most outstanding linemen. This was, I should say that most of these awards, there's six of them, five of them I had a really hard time debating on who to pick where. There was only one where I was like, this was a no-brainer. It was an offensive lineman. So I kind of brought it down to Mike Filer and Ryan Bomben because I think Bomben's addition to the offensive line, especially when he was playing, was spectacular. He helped really solidify that offensive line. But I ended up going with Mike Filer. We have talked about him before, and I've especially been high on Filer in past episodes. He was a whipping boy last year. There was calls for his head. No one seemed to have any confidence in him. I wanted to preach patience. I believe you were the same way. He's a young guy learning to start at maybe the most difficult position on the offensive line. He's got to make all those calls. And he was filling in for a legend, a Ticats legend in Marwan Hage. Those are big shoes to fill, and I think Filer has filled them admirably. He has just recently been rewarded with a 3-year contract extension, so he's here for the long term, and I think this season he's played in every game, and I don't think there's been an offensive lineman better on this team than Mike Filer.
Yeah, both Filer and Bomben will be here for a while, with both having contract extensions. You know, they'll be side by side on the offensive line for 2 or 3 years. So yeah, it's a tough decision. It's hard to judge offensive line play when you're just watching on TV if you don't, you know, really focus on them. So it'd be tough for me to call, but I'd have to, if I had to pick, I'd go with Filer because he just had he had not a terrible season last year, but not a great season. You know, like you said, he was a whipping boy from Ticat fans, and he's just had such a great bounce back season and really proved the doubters wrong. So if I had to choose, I'd definitely take Filer.
Yeah, I think this may be more of a reward for how far he's come as opposed to, because like you said, it is really hard to judge offensive line play, especially because we really only talk about them when they're performing either super poorly, like they did this past week giving up 6 sacks, or superly, where they give up no sacks. And even then we talk about them as a unit. We're not really talking about the individual players. So yeah, you're right. It is really difficult to judge offensive line play. So yeah, I handed it to Filer, maybe strictly on how far he's come, and he's become a fan favorite now. So that says a lot, especially when it comes to filling in for essentially what is a legend in Marwan Hage. So most outstanding rookie to me was the only no-brainer on the list. I selected Terrence Tolliver and didn't even think twice about it.
Yeah, you gotta. I mean, he was leading the Ticats in receiving yards at one point. You know, he's been out for a bit now with an injury, but he's the guy that stands out. He's the pick for rookie of the year for the Ticats. So yeah, that's a no brainer to me. There's got to be Tolliver.
Yeah, he made the team as a starter out of training camp as a rookie. Any other rookies in the team, there's been contributions from a ton of first-year players, but yeah, Tolliver was the guy. So most outstanding Canadian, this one, I think we might finally disagree on something here, because this was, to me, a toss-up between two players again. This was down to Ted Laurent, who is amazing in the middle, and Courtney Steven. And Steven got my pick. We have been really low on the defensive line recently, and Laurent is a player on the defensive line. So they just haven't performed. They just haven't played well, period. Since about Labor Day, Laurent's numbers are down from last year. He had 9 sacks a season ago, and this year he only has 3. And I know interior defensive linemen you can't entirely judge them on the numbers they put up. And Laurent is still a force in the middle. But I went with Steven because I think he's had a breakout season in the secondary. 4 interceptions so far this year. He's near the top of the team's leaderboard in that respect. He's done a great job as the wide side corner. He's really developed into a solid player. And he came into the league as a safety, and they converted him to corner. And while it wasn't by any means seamless, he's done a great job out there on an island.
Yeah, you know, earlier in the year, it was Fantuz that was really standing out as a Canadian. If he didn't get injured, he probably would have had you know, a great year, probably over 1,000 yards. He was on pace for that. So, you know, if he doesn't get injured, it'll probably be Fantuz. But I got to go with you. Like, I know it just seemed like I'm agreeing with you, but I got to go with Stevens as well. He's really impressed me.
I'm surprised. I thought you'd go with Laurent. Honestly, I did. Yeah. That's a bit of a surprise.
No, I got to agree with you because, like you said, the offensive line, or the defensive line is just not been doing it lately. It's Laurent, I'm sure, he's a great player. Obviously, he's great in the middle. He's a bull in there. But yeah, like, I've been noticing Steven a lot this year. He's flying around there. He's making tackles. He's getting interceptions. He's just doing a great job in the defensive backfield. So I got to go with Stevens as well.
So most outstanding defensive player. There are so many guys on the defense that you could pick. Heck, you could pick Steven if you really wanted to. Mm-hmm. Taylor Reed's had a great year. Justin Hickman has 8 sacks, kind of having a bounce back year after last year's rather subpar season after he returned to Hamilton. But my pick was the man we were talking about a little bit earlier, Simone Lawrence. He's a playmaker in a playmaking defense. He's all over the field, leads the team in tackles. He's their leader. It's Emmanuel Davis. Could have it. I know it was going to be impossible for him to keep up the pace of scoring a touchdown every time he got an interception, but he's cooled a little bit, and maybe that's just a product of teams shying away from him when he's covering a receiver. But to me, Lawrence is just the all-round defensive player on this team and the easy pick for most outstanding defensive player.
He's one of the leaders on the defense. I mean, he leads the charge in the pregame stuff when the defense is huddling up before the game, so he's a real leader. He's a great player. He's flying around there. He makes plays all the time. He's just really enthusiastic. He loves, you know, he just loves to play football. He's just a really excitable guy. You know, he just leads by example. So I got to agree with you and go with Lawrence. Even though I'm really high on Davis, I think he's done a great job filling in for Delvin Bro, who's doing really well in the NFL right now. You know, Simone Lawrence is 1 and Davis is 1A, in my opinion. They're just two great players, but I got to give the nod to Lawrence.
So 5 for 5, we share the same pick. So now we get to the big one, most outstanding player. Now, to me, there were 3 players that you could consider for this award. Zach Collaros, obviously, he was out of this world. He would have won the award, as far as I'm concerned, if he would have stayed healthy. I don't think there's any dispute there. Put up whatever Burris has done, or Eric Rogers, or Bo Levi Mitchell, or any player you want to talk about, Collaros would have trumped them. I think Collaros still has more touchdown passes than Burris has, and Collaros hasn't played since mid-September. So that just tells you how good Collaros was playing at the time of his injury.
Yeah, and his touchdown to interception ratio was off the charts too.
Yeah, it's like 25-8 or something like that. Like, it's ridiculous. But here's the thing. I couldn't vote for him because of the injury. And I know there was a lot of people out there going, well, Ricky Ray was the East nominee after playing only half a season, and John Cornish was the most outstanding Canadian after only playing half a season. I didn't have a say in either of those picks, and the Ray one especially I wouldn't have made. I don't like the idea of a player missing most of the season and still getting recognition for a full season's worth of work. But the difference with Ray and Collaros is Ray missed mid-season games and then came back at the end and was allowed to establish himself again. Whereas Collaros, we only have what he did in the first half, and I don't like to project forward. For all we know, he could have fallen off a cliff. It's completely unlikely. He was likely going to just light this league on fire. But I can't say that he would have for sure, because we don't know. So to me, it came down to Tasker and Sinkfield. Terrell Sinkfield and Luke Tasker were the two guys that ended up picking 1 and 2, and I went with Luke Tasker. I don't really have a reason for it. I can't give you, like, he's done this, and he's done that, and it was a gut decision. Those were the two guys I was debating between, and I ended up going with Tasker.
Oh, that surprised me. I thought you'd go for with Sinkfield for sure. You know, Tasker's just that reliable guy. He's just always there, and he has that rapport with Matthews now. If you need a first down, you go to Tasker. If you need a big play, you go to Sinkfield. So it's a really tough decision. You know, they're both high up there on the receiving yards for the team. But I'd have to go with Tasker as well. I just think he's that reliable, dependable receiver that you can always go to if you're in a bind. And I think that he's going to, you know, be the best player going forward into the playoffs too. So Sinkfield's been great, and I've been high on him all season. He's really proven himself as a reliable receiver, but I just got to go with Tasker as well.
I am shocked. I would have bet your house on you picking Sinkfield. I would have thought, because of how much you've slurped him, and I don't mean that in a negative way, because he's deserved it. He's been great this year. I thought there was no way you weren't picking that. I figured we'd probably agree on most of these, but I thought that this would be the one where we diverged, and I would have bet anything on you saying Terrell Sinkfield was the team's MOP.
I love what Sinkfield's done this year, but I just think that Tasker's the number one guy in that offense right now. I think he's, like I said before, I just think he's so reliable. He's like my favorite player on the team. He's just there all the time when they need first down. So, yeah, I know that I've been, you know, praising Sinkfield all season, but I'm going with Tasker.
So we ended up agreeing on all of them, which is a bit of a surprise. But let's... when we see other player awards come out, maybe we'll revisit this with the division awards and the league awards. And heck, maybe we'll even just come up with our own awards and hand some out to the players of the league across CFL later in the season.
Yeah, we'll disagree on some of those, I'm sure.
We have to. We have to disagree about something. All right, so let's get into the rest of the action in the CFL this week. Friday night saw the Lions clinch their playoff spot. They didn't know it at the time, but they clinched their playoff spot by beating Toronto in Toronto 27-25. It wasn't exactly the most thrilling of games, definitely better than the one I went to on Sunday, but the thing that stood out to me was the terrible kicking performances by both BC and Toronto. There was a blocked punt, a blocked field goal, and three missed field goals in total, one of them being the block and two just being... I can't even describe you. If you haven't seen the missed field goals by Toronto's kicker, whose name escapes me and doesn't really matter because I believe they cut him the next day anyway, they were two of the worst misses I have ever seen. So I got to ask you, do you think that was the worst kicking performance maybe in the history of football?
Well, it was up there, you know. You got to go back to Harlahu earlier in the season. That was that could have been the worst ever. But yeah, those field goals were just so wide. I mean, it's ridiculous. Like, he just shanked them so badly. But, you know, he's released now. Rodgers, I believe it was, for Toronto. So, and Leone missed a couple of extra points, I believe.
Oh, you're right. I completely forgot about it. He did miss extra points.
Yeah. So it was pretty bad. In years past, I've noticed that in the CFL, sometimes the kicking... field goal kicking has been rather poor. I think that's changed this year and last year. I think it's been pretty good. But yeah, that game was just terrible for the kicking game.
I was watching it just kind of in awe. Like, I was dumbstruck by, and I'm glad you mentioned the missed extra points because I completely forgot about those, but those should have been in here too. Just like, how do you, like, so we have a blocked punt that was returned for a touchdown. We have a blocked field goal. We have two missed field goals and two missed extra points. Yeah, Hirolahu's individual performance might have been worse, but this had to have been the worst performance by both teams' kickers in a single game.
Now, speaking of performances, how do you think Ray played in his first start?
He looked rusty. I think he looked like a guy making his first start in a year. I don't think he was terrible. He definitely does look like he's lost some zip on the fastball. The touchdown pass to, I believe his name's Phil Bates. It was quacking. I don't know if you heard the quacks, but I definitely heard the quacks. That was fluttering something fierce. And BC has got to be kicking themselves for letting the receiver get up and go get that, because that was a really poorly thrown ball.
Yeah, it was. It was totally, you know, the receiver made a play on that ball. He was open, and then Ray really underthrew him, and he had to come back. Yeah, it was a flutterer for sure. But, you know, he didn't do bad, but I think his offensive line did terrible. You know, he was sacked six times, and he was rushed at least another six times. So he was there was defenders in his face the whole game. You know, you have to give Ray time. He's a guy that it's an absolute must that he has time to make his reads and wind up. Because he's not exactly, when he tosses the ball, it's not exactly a quick release. He's a guy that winds up, and it's kind of a slow release. So I don't think it's fair to judge him necessarily in this game because the offensive line just played so poorly.
Yeah, I agree. That offensive line play was atrocious. He did not seem to get a ton of time back there at any point in the game, even though you said they had six sacks?
Yep.
Yeah, even just the pressure on him all night was pretty ferocious. Didn't really seem to get comfortable, but I still think that it looks to me like the Argos made the right decision because he didn't seem to get rattled. Sort of the one thing that you can say about Ricky Ray is that he can get battered and bruised and his emotion doesn't change. Trevor Harris played poorly and you could kind of see it get to him. Ray just stays calm, cool, and collected. That's just the way he is. And I think that, I believe they play Winnipeg this week, and they're now locked in after Ottawa's victory over Hamilton. The Argos are locked in third in the East. They're going on the road for the playoffs. I think this will be an interesting game to watch just because neither team have anything to play for, but are we going to see Ray get all the time? Are we going to see a split between him and Harris? Have they now decided after that game that Ray's the guy going forward? It makes for some interesting questions.
Yeah, Drew Ray's one of his biggest assets, that he's just a cool-headed guy. You know, he could score a winning touchdown to win the Grey Cup, and you don't really see much expression on his face. So that's one of his better traits, because he just doesn't get rattled.
No, you know, he doesn't get rattled. And yeah, that's just, it's the way he plays the game. And I think that calming presence brings something to the Argos that they were lacking with Harris. I know they played well earlier in the season, but Harris definitely seems like an emotional guy. And to have Ray back there being that calm presence that he is, I think it might be sort of the thing that the Argos were missing earlier in the season.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's just a really interesting situation to what they're going to do in Toronto.
Well, we're going to see how it plays out over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
So the Rough Riders went into Calgary and just got smacked around. Let's be honest. Calgary wins that game 42-19. The Riders, what are they, 2-15 now? Their season had long been lost. But it seems that there's it's hard to say a controversy, but there seems to be a little bit of a quarterback conundrum brewing in Saskatchewan. Both Brett Smith and Keith Price saw, I would say, equal-ish playing time. And it looked to me like Price outperformed Smith. So I got to wonder which one of those two is maybe their backup next year or their QB of the future in a possible post-Darian Durant era.
Yeah, it's tough to call. You know, Price has looked good when he's been in there. Smith has had his flashes as well. I think you're going to need to see more playing time. You'll probably maybe get a split. They actually said that Price will get a start before the season ends, so maybe he gets the start next week. He probably will. So maybe you get to see more of him. It's going to be, I'm pretty sure it's going to come down to training camp next year. They're just going to battle it out for second spot. But Price has looked pretty good when he's been in there, so maybe he has the edge right now.
Yeah, I'm a big Brett Smith fan. I thought he had played really well during some really difficult situations, because this Saskatchewan team has been decimated for talent. Not even just injuries. There's just not a lot of talent on that team, frankly. And this is a lost season for them. And I thought getting Smith in there, especially a few weeks ago when they still had Kevin Glenn, I thought Smith should be the guy in there, develop him, see what he has. Price does look pretty good too. I think they're going to have a really interesting quarterback battle in training camp next year for that number two spot. Obviously Durant's going to be the number one when he comes back and he's fully healthy. And given the fact that he'll have missed an entire season, I don't think there's any reason to believe he won't come back and still be able to perform. But yeah, I'm not sure which one of these two I'd pick, because I like both of them for different reasons. But recency bias would say that Price could be the guy.
Yeah, it looks like they have behind Durant, they have a couple of pretty good young quarterbacks, so that now have a little bit of experience. So if Durant goes down next year, maybe they'll be okay with Price or Smith. So it should be interesting to see. You know, you don't really talk about who's going to be the second string quarterback on teams very often, but yeah, it's something to keep an eye on next year in training camp with the Riders.
Yeah, I think the Riders have a lot of young players that have fortunately been able to get some playing time this year. Naaman Roosevelt, I think, has played really well. Ryan Smith has been a really good player. Nick Dembski has performed really well for a first-year guy out of the CIS. There's some pieces there. Jeff Knox Jr. on defense. There's some pieces there in Saskatchewan that they could turn this around, I think, quicker than most people are anticipating. I'm not saying that they're going to be battling with Calgary and Edmonton for first in the West, but I wouldn't be surprised to see them go from a 2 or possibly 3 win season this year to close to 500 next year. They've got some stuff there. There's obviously some holes still to fill. That offensive line is not good. Their Canadian talent is woefully thin. But they have some young guys there that I think can emerge as players in this league.
Yeah, you never know. Maybe they squeak into the playoffs next year. In the third spot in the West, or maybe a crossover or something. Well, maybe not a crossover, but you never know. You can turn around quick in the CFL. So if they draft well and they sign a couple more players in the offseason, free agents maybe, and Durant comes back healthy, maybe they turn around next season. Now, Jerome Messam made his debut with the Stampeders against the Riders this weekend. So, and he had a pretty darn good game. So do you think Messam is the best running back in the league right now?
I don't think there's any way to say he's not. He is durable, unlike Cornish. He has performed, even when he was in Saskatchewan, when they would actually give him the damn ball, he performed well for them. Then he goes to Calgary, and first game in, he goes over 100 yards rushing? Like, come on. This is just the rich getting richer, and if I'm Edmonton right now, and if I'm BC, I know people talk a lot about BC being the team no one wants to face in the playoffs. I don't want to face the Calgary Stampeders because they are going to have a chip on their shoulder. And Jerome Messam's really out there trying to prove who he is as a player. He's been shipped around quite a bit. He was in BC, then Edmonton, then Montreal, then Saskatchewan, now Calgary. He's on the Kevin Glenn pick up every jersey tour. But yeah, he is just, he's been in beast mode, I think, all season. Whenever he's had the ball in his hands, he has produced. So yeah, I would give him the nod as the top running back in the league right now, for sure.
Yeah, he's up there. I really like Sutton in Montreal. I think they do a great job with Sutton and Rutley. But right now, I think it's Messam. You know, he came in, got 115 yards on the ground against, you know, against Saskatchewan, but still got a touchdown. So he's going to, you know, if Cornish isn't in, Messam is a great replacement for him. I mean, you don't lose a step at all. Don't lose the ratio spot. He's just a great overall back. So, and he can catch it on the backfield. You know, he's a strong runner. So I got to give the nod to him at this moment. I think he's the best in league right now.
I want to ask you this. This might sound insane, but given Cornish's health and given how well Messam's played and given that Messam is a free agent, what do you think the odds are that Calgary maybe cuts ties with John Cornish and re-signs Jerome Messam and he's their starting running back next year?
That's, wow, that'd be bold. It could happen, though, you know. Like Cornish has had his injury problems. Messam's been pretty healthy. I'm not sure. I think they're around the same age. Do you know how old Messam is? I think he's 30, maybe?
I want to say Messam's younger than Cornish, but if he is, it wouldn't be by much. So let's fire up Google and find out. So Jerome Messam is 30 years old. John Cornish is, this is riveting, riveting radio, also 30 years old. So the exact same age.
I got to give it to Messam. I think he's, you know, Cornish has been the best player in the league last year and maybe the year before too. But he's just, you know, I'm sure he's going to come back and he's going to prove us all wrong and have a great season next year maybe. But at this point, I think I'd go with Messam. I think he's such a dynamic player out there with his size and his power, and he has good speed for a guy his size. So maybe you go with Messam and cut Cornish loose or see if you can trade him.
I know, sounds crazy though, right? We're talking about the guy who, he won't win Most Outstanding Canadian this year, but is the three-time reigning Most Outstanding Canadian. He has the Most Outstanding Player Award. He's a Grey Cup ring. It's almost insane to wonder if they would let him go, but football is a business first and foremost, and if you're not going to get production out of Cornish has been hurt now, what is this, 3 years in a row? At least two. He missed half the season last year, and he missed most of the season this year. So it seems like age is taking its effect on him, and Messam is just durable. At least he has been recently. So I don't know. This might be something that only I'm thinking, but I don't know. I think it bears watching in the offseason. What happens with Calgary's running back situation?
You'd think you can't keep both. I mean, they'd both be a high-priced ticket. So, you know, but you can't keep the both of them. So you're going to have to make a decision in the offseason. I'm pretty sure Messam is a free agent in the offseason. So either sign him up or, you know, rely on Cornish that he's not going to get injured again.
So Sunday afternoon was the last game of the week after the Ticats game, and it was Edmonton clinching first place in the West Division and ending Montreal's playoff streak. The Owls will not make the playoffs this year for the first time since they returned to the league in 1996. But the interesting thing to me from this game was who was on the sidelines as head coach for Montreal. It was Noel Thorpe. Jim Popp had some sort of issue, some health issue. Do you know what it was?
Yeah, I believe it was vertigo.
He had vertigo. Okay, so he wasn't able to make the game, so he ceded control of the team on the sidelines to Thorpe. Now, there's been a lot of talk about Noel Thorpe being a potential head coaching candidate because of how great Montreal's defense has played. This game's not exactly a great thing to showcase on his resume, considering they allowed 40 points, but he had coached that defense amazingly this year. So I'm wondering, do you think this may have been Thorpe's audition for the head coaching job in Montreal?
You'd have to think so. I mean, there's been a lot of rumblings over the years that Thorpe might get a head coaching opportunity in Montreal or somewhere else. You know, he's been great as a defensive coordinator for years for them, so he could have been an audition. You know, maybe Pop steps down or maybe he gets fired in the offseason. I don't know what's going to happen there, but I don't think it would be a bad decision to hire from within and give Thorpe a chance to be the head coach going forward, because he's just been so great for the organization for many years. So, yeah, it could have been an audition for, you know, wasn't a great audition. I think whoever made that decision to bring in Marsh on the goal line, you know, give the ball to that bozo. I don't know who made that call. But it could have been an audition for sure.
Bozo, I'm sorry. That's going to take me a while to get over that one. Yeah, that was a pretty horrendous decision. I call him Turnover Tanner because of how often he turns over the ball. But we call him Bozo if you like. No, I think it absolutely was an audition for Noel Thorpe. I think he, let's see, Saskatchewan's going to have an opening, obviously, for a head coach. Maybe Winnipeg does as well. We don't know how that's going to go there. I think O'Shea will get a third year to right that ship, but they're worse this year than they were last year, so anything's possible. It's the CFL. Coaches get fired. Marcel Belfay got fired after the team got to the East Final, so you can be successful and still get fired. It happens. And obviously, I don't think Jim Popp is going to be the head coach next year. Even if he wanted to be the head coach, I think he'll allow...
He's had his chances, you know. He's had his chances as a head coach. It hasn't gone well.
Exactly. So I think his resume as a head coach speaks for itself. I think Thorpe could be the guy there. I like continuity on the staff. I think you move Thorpe up. Kavis Reed is there, so maybe he becomes defensive coordinator. Maybe Thorpe keeps both titles. I don't know how it would go. Maybe Reed sticks as special teams coordinator, because their special teams this year has actually been pretty good. So he's done a decent job. It helps that he has talented players, obviously. Their kicker, their rookie out of Laval, Beattie, has been amazing. Stefan Logan, we talked about a little bit earlier. He's, despite his advanced age, and I hate saying that because he's only, I think, 34, which is just a year older than me, but he's played really well. The special teams unit for Montreal has been really good, so maybe Reed stays there. But I think moving Thorpe up to the head job wouldn't be a terrible decision.
No, I totally agree. He's overdue for a chance to be a head coach. Now, are the S the favorite to win the Cup?
Yes.
With their offense seeming to be back on track?
Yeah, you didn't even have to finish that question. Yes, the answer is yes. I think they are the heavy favorites to win the Cup. Seeing as how the last game between Hamilton and Ottawa played out, I really don't see a team in the East being able to go to the Grey Cup in Winnipeg and beat one of these two West teams, honestly, unless something completely shocking happens and BC finds a way to run the table and gets to the Grey Cup. I think the winner of the... And I'm going to presume it's going to be Calgary and Edmonton in the West Final. I think the winner of the West Final is winning the Grey Cup, and I think it's going to be the Esks. A few weeks ago, we broke down where the Esks and Stamps would finish, and the one game that I had them... The one question I had was the game that they ended up getting the tiebreaker over Calgary, and could they beat Calgary and Calgary? Whoever won that game, I thought was going to win the West. Edmonton's run the table. What do they want? 8 in a row now? They're two wins away. Ten wins in a row is a lot of wins, but yeah, I got to give it to the S. I would be surprised if there's any other team other than them hoisting the Grey Cup in Winnipeg at the end of November.
Yeah, their defense has been spectacular all year long. You know, it was a question of whether their offense could get back on track, and it looks like they have. I asked you last week if you thought that Riley depended too much on Bowman. Well, Bowman didn't see the ball a ton, and he spread it around pretty well. You know, Darrell Walker had a huge game, so I gotta agree that they're the favorites right now. They seem to be clicking just at the right time. The only question is now, how will they do with the 3-week layoff? You know, that's a long time to be laying off. They'll be able to rest up. They'll be able to get players back like Grimes in the secondary and maybe Shakir Bell. I'm not sure the extent of his injury, but even without Shakir Bell, I really like Chad Simpson. You know, I think he runs the ball really well. So they have a lot of weapons on offense, and they're finally, you know, utilizing all of them. So yeah, Calgary's going to be a tough test if they play them in the West Final. That's going to be a hell of a game because they look pretty good on offense as well, so, and their defense is nothing to sneeze at either. So, but as of this moment, I got to give it to Edmonton as well.
And this is something that I completely let slip my mind. They signed Nick Grigsby. Even if they don't like Chad Simpson or if Shakir Bell doesn't come back, Nick Grigsby got to a Grey Cup last year with the Ticats and was really good for them down the stretch last year. He was on and off the team this year, obviously, and that is what it is. But they have a ton of weapons on offense, and it really does look like they clicked. But I'm with you. This 3-week break, this 21 days between games, I said last week I thought Edmonton was going to come out rusty no matter when they played their playoff game. I still see that happening, but yeah, if they can click like this, even if they have half a quarter or even a quarter of slow football, the defense, I think, is good enough to keep them in it. They're not going to be down 21-0 after the first quarter in the West Final. If this offense clicks the way it's clicked against Montreal, and I think this is sort of the game they needed to get over the hump because they had not performed well. And like you said, Riley had relied on Bowman a little too much, didn't really rely on him at all this week. So he had 2 catches for 12 yards. He spread the ball around. Like, 9 different players catch a pass. Even if he catches for 7 and he catches for 8 and this guy 2 for 17 or whatever, that's still spreading the ball around. That's still keeping the defense honest when it comes to guarding receivers. Like I said, I think this is Edmonton's year. I think things play out differently if a certain quarterback here in Hamilton's not injured. But as it stands right now, I'm all in on the asks.
Yeah, it's just such a shame. I mean, there would have been such a... You know, if Hamilton would have made it to the Grey Cup with Claros, it would have been such a nice battle between Hamilton and Edmonton or Hamilton and Calgary, but... happens, so what are you going
to
do?
It wasn't meant to be.
Yeah.
All right, so let's get into what I think is going to be a bit of a mini game preview. It's kind of hard to preview a game that's a rematch of a game that just happened, and basically all the things we said last week, they didn't do this week, and all the things we said they should do, like, you know what I mean? It's just, it's kind of tough to find new things to talk about, because the same things hold true from last week. They need to protect the football. They didn't do that this week. They need to not let the quarterback get pressured and sacked. They didn't do that. Defensively, they did everything they needed to do. I think that the secondary played really well against Ottawa's receivers. There wasn't a whole lot there pretty much after the first quarter. They shut them down. Now, there was a lot of drops, too. Chris Williams had a couple of really bad drops for Ottawa. But, again, I'm not going to sit here and nitpick on the defense when they allowed four field goals. So here's basically the scenario for the Ticats. They got to go into Ottawa, and they got to win by six or more points. They do that, they're in first place. It's six, not seven, because they hold the tiebreaker if they're even in points due to division record. So the Ticats would be 4-1 in the division. Ottawa would be, I believe, 1-4. Because they would have one win over the Ticats, lost to Ticats, 3 to Toronto. The Ticats win if they can beat Ottawa by six or more points. If they don't, then it's the Battle of Ontario here into Hamilton in the East semifinal between Toronto and the Ticats. So that's pretty much where we stand.
Yeah, it's. I don't remember the last time, total points has happened for a playoff spot, but it should be interesting. You know, it's that also they just have to do what they didn't do in this game. You know, pressure burst, we talked about it last week, blah blah blah, we're just repeating ourselves, but they take out Burst's knee. No, I'm just joking.
Oh, you're gonna get the ire of our nation on that one.
I'm just joking. I don't want to see anyone get injured, but yeah, you know, they can't turn over the ball. It's plain and simple, especially near the end zone. You know, if Matthews doesn't see anyone open, don't throw the ball. Just throw it away or whatever. Take the points. Take the 3 points. Just do not throw interceptions. Do not fumble the ball. You know, if the Ticats get the home playoff game in the East final, you know, they're just one game away. They can do it. I know I was, you know, I'm a little bit down on the team, but if they get that home field advantage, you never know what can happen. So, you know, they could have won that game this weekend. It was very close. It came down to the end. So they just have to eliminate the turnovers and let that defense do its thing and maybe score a touchdown or two and they can win. So just get it together and we'll win by six and boom, bing, bang, boom, we got the East final.
I don't want to take any credit away from Ottawa for winning the game, but they didn't play particularly well on Sunday, so it's not like they came in and blew the doors off the Ticats. The Ticats' offense played terribly, and they still only lost by six. And like you said, we talked about those interceptions earlier. If he just eats the ball and gets sacked, there's two field goals. Medlock, from that short of a distance, is not going to miss. There we go. It's 12-12. We're going to overtime. Whole new ball game. Or maybe even on that last play, that non-Hail Mary dump-off pass to Tasker that ended the game. Maybe they try to punt for a single or kick for a field goal. Who knows? Any number of things could have changed based on the Ticats not turning the ball over that deep in their own territory. I'm with you. I'm down. I'm not out. I'm not out on this team, but I am down on them. But I think if they're ever going to have a bounce-back performance, if they ever needed motivation to get a win, this is the week to do it. This is the week to finally put it all together. I don't know if they can do it. I'm hoping they can.
It's going to be must-watch television. You know, they just have to – it's a must-win. Plus six. Got to do it.
It's the only game of the week that means anything. Every other game played in week 20 has no playoff implications whatsoever. So this is the main event. This is the World Heavyweight Championship match. This is game two of what I have dubbed the East Division Championship Series. Ticats are down by six. They got to win by six. It's as simple as that. So let's see where it all falls on Sunday afternoon. I'm going to the game. I'm super excited for this. I love the city of Ottawa. So any reason for me to go there, I will take. This is a bonus. I can't wait. So I'm hoping this team comes out fired up and ready to go. There's going to be a lot of booze rained down on them, especially a certain number 21 after what happened on this past Sunday. So personally, I like going into opposing team stadium and being the bad guy. I there's something about being the heel. I'm a big wrestling fan. I know you're a wrestling fan. There's something about being the bad guy and having people boo you that just, it kind of pumps me up. So I'm sitting right behind the Ticats bench. I think I'm like 5 or 6 rows back, so I'm going to be loud. Maybe I'll be on TV. Who knows? Maybe I'll even get on television and make a fool of myself. But I can't wait for this game. I'm pumped. I'm psyching myself up that the Ticats can win this. So I don't know. I'm ready to go. I wish it was Saturday already and I was already in Ottawa.
Yeah, it's you know, the crowd's going to be wild. You know, the first, you know, they're going to want that East final, and I'm sure both teams are going to be fired up. It's going to be, you know, there's a new rivalry brewing in the East, so I'm pumped to watch it as well.
Yeah, the CFL spent a lot of time this year trying to build a Toronto-Ottawa rivalry. I don't know if you noticed that through social media and even through the CFL.ca website, but I think it's Ottawa and Hamilton that are going to build sort of a little bit of a hate relationship for each other.
It's tough to build a rivalry, you know, when there's not anything there necessarily. You know, this kind of just naturally happened. You know, there wasn't huge rivalry before this game, but now it seems to have naturally occurred through the what happened in the game. So, you know, it's just organic, and it seems to be building. It's going to be building up to next week. I'm sure there's going to be words in the press with the players. So it's good to see rivalries, you know, start up in the CFL. It makes the games more interesting.
For sure. Organic rivalries are the best rivalries. Contrived, manipulated rivalries, those are no good. All right, so are you ready to make some bold predictions?
Okay, I should go with, I'm going to go with Tasker. I know I've gone with Tasker quite a bit, but I'm going to say he gets 8 catches for 100 yards and a touchdown.
Okie dokie. I still have the Brandon Banks one going, obviously, but as I said earlier, I'm already chalking that one up as an incorrect pick. So this one is a bit different. I'm going that the Ticats will win the turnover battle, the sack battle, and the time of possession battle. Those are three things that Ottawa won in the last game, and I'm saying it's reversed this week, and the Ticats win all three of those battles, and if that happens, they win this football game.
Those are three huge stats that you got to think if they win all three of those, Ticats will be coming away with victory, hopefully by 6.
All right, so a little different format this week. We're going to head into the questions, but they were all sent to me, so in a role reversal, I am going to ask you the questions this week.
Giddy up.
Now, we got a ton about quarterbacking, so let's just get into those right away. It seems to be the, if we're not talking about the Lawrence hit on Burris, we're talking about quarterback play because Jeff Matthews did not play very well last week. So the first question we have about quarterbacking is this. Most of these come from the same guy, Adam, who writes in the comment section on 3Down Nation. That's why I'm reading most of the questions this week. So he asks, is Austin's biggest flaw as a head coach and GM that he gives too long a leash to QBs he coached in college? He gave a longer leash to Matthews, who had nothing versus Ottawa and shouldn't have played in the fourth quarter, and last season gave his QB when he was OC at Mississippi, Jeremiah Mazzoli, too many games as a starter when he struggled. So what do you think? Do you think this is a flaw in Austin's coaching and talent evaluating skills?
Not really. I think that, you know, Mazzoli had a lot of promise. I think I was high on him. You know, he played well in the preseason games. I know that doesn't mean much, but he had a tough go. You know, he gave him some time. But you gotta give quarterbacks some time. You gotta see what they have. You know, you can't judge them by one quarter or two quarters. So he gave some time, but ever since then, you know, he's been down the depth chart. So I don't think that he has been sympathetic towards Mazzoli. He saw what he had, and then he sent him down the depth chart. So, and Matthews, he hasn't played terribly in a couple games. He hasn't played great, but I think that he deserved to play this game. You know, I think that he moved the ball pretty well at times in the last game and then messed it up by throwing interceptions. You know, he said he's going to evaluate the quarterback position going into next week, so we'll see if he goes back to Matthews or not. But no, I don't think it's a flaw. I think that he just made judgment calls on both players, and I don't see why you take out Matthews up to this point in the season, you know, so I don't think it's a flaw on his part, no.
I'm not sure if I'd call it a flaw. He is a pretty stubborn guy. Let's yeah. Call a spade and be honest. Austin's pretty headstrong, and that's what tends to rub people the wrong way. The Mazzoli thing last year, I never understood personally. I know he played well in the preseason game, but I was always high on Dan Lefevre and thought that he should have been the backup to Zach Caleros last year. Heck, I thought that it should have been a straight-up quarterback duel between Lefevre and Caleros in training camp for the starting job, but obviously I've been proven wrong on that aspect. Caleros has taken off, and Lefevre, unfortunately, can't seem to stay healthy. Look, it's really hard for me to criticize Kent Austin too much simply because of what he's done with this team. He's now coached 3 seasons in Hamilton, and they've been .500 or better every year. He has two 10-win seasons, which this team doesn't win 10 games basically ever. 9-9 was the ceiling for them for the longest time. But yeah, it is kind of interesting that he gives a little bit of a longer leash to the guys that he's familiar with. I don't know if Jacory Harris would have been given as much of an opportunity to work himself out of the failures that Matthews had. But like you said, Masoli was not dressing for most of the season. He didn't dress until Caleros got hurt. Jacory Harris, who he did not coach in college, won the number three job. So yeah, I wasn't a huge fan of some of the moves he's made at quarterback with the guys that he's known before, but it's a little much, I think, to say it's like a killer flaw. The next question about quarterbacks, but this comes from Andrew on Twitter. His question is simply, why not bench Matthews in the second half for Harris when Matthews did little in the first half?
Once again, I just think that Austin, you know, believes in this guy. Obviously, we know, we talked about earlier, he coached him in college at Cornell. You know, he did all those great things in the Ivy League. You know, it's just, I think that we could have won the game if he just doesn't throw those interceptions. So I think that Austin was just keeping with him. You know, just gotta, you know, keep riding him, because you're bringing Harris, and maybe he stinks it up more than Matthews did. So yes, he didn't have a good first half, but they were still in the game, so I think he was just putting all his trust in Matthews.
The game was 9-6 at halftime. Neither team's offense neither team's offense would go on to do anything. Matthews was 8 of 16 for 62 yards, but he hadn't thrown any of the interceptions yet. Those all came in the second half. So he didn't really give a reason for Austin to have pulled him at any point, really. He wasn't playing great, but it's not like he had cost the team anything. He hadn't turned the ball over. Like, I guess he had that fumble that was very controversial. I think Sean Lemon hit it out of his hand, and there doesn't seem to be a consensus on whether or not that was a fumble or an incomplete pass. But Matthews, yeah, he didn't look great. But the team was still only down by 3. I don't think you pull the quarterback at that point.
No, I totally agree. I mean, yeah, they're still in the game. You know, they're only down by 3. So, you know, maybe he thought Matthews could have a bounce back second half. That's not how it turned out. But I don't see any reasoning why they put in Jacoby Harris.
Yep, I'm with you on that one. Mark asks, not to stir a QB controversy, but would you use Harris and Mazzoli like they did late in 2013 against Montreal? Now, for those that don't know, it was, I believe, the second or third last week of the season. The Ticats were on the verge of clinching a playoff spot, and they needed to beat the Alouettes to do so, and they did, and they mixed in these run packages and these option packages for Dan Lefevre and Jeremiah Mazzoli that worked to perfection. It was one of the things that people praised Austin for, using all his players on his bench and finding an unconventional way to win games. And it worked. So I guess Mark wants to know, would you try to do the same thing in this last game with Harris in place of Lefevre?
Yeah, it did work. It was against the Montreal team with, Jonathan Crompton, I think, was the quarterback, and the offense wasn't...
Nope, it was Troy Smith.
Oh, okay, so even worse. Troy Smith. It was a very, very windy day in Guelph that day. And yes, they did it a bit at the end of the season. I don't like the... It worked, but I don't like the two quarterback system. I just don't like a revolving door, one quarterback going in, one quarterback going out. So no, I wouldn't do that. I'd just keep Matthews in there, let him get a rhythm and see what he can do.
Yeah, I'm kind of torn on this because we've seen it work in the past, but just because something works in the past doesn't mean it's going to work again. So I like Jacory Harris as a quarterback. I really do. I think he has a lot of skills necessary to be a very good player in the CFL. But yeah, I think doing that now, you pretty much just shatter any confidence that Jeff Matthews has left, which is probably very little. So I don't really see them doing it, and I don't think I'd go that route either. So one more final question about quarterbacks, and then we can move on to a ton of other questions about other crap that people are mad about. This comes from a friend of mine, Adam, a different Adam. This is a guy that I went to high school with and used to go to games with and all that stuff. And he asks, should Austin look for a more seasoned backup in the offseason?
It depends. Depends how much it costs. Depends who's out there. You know, like Glenn's locked up in Montreal next year. I don't really know who else would be available.
Bring Lefevre back?
Lefevre, yeah. Well, yeah, that would be an option. You know, he's coming off that bad knee injury, but he has a little bit of experience. But I think that if I'm an Austin Jets, I think he's thinking bring back who he has. I think he's happy with this, the young quarterbacks behind, and he probably used that money that he spent on a veteran quarterback to go out and get more starting talent. So, you know, it's always a good thing to have an experienced backup, but I don't think Austin's going to go that way.
I don't think he will either. I wanted him to go that route this past offseason, get a veteran behind Zach Caleros. I wanted it to be Kevin Glenn, and that didn't happen. He went to Saskatchewan, and I was totally against any trade involving him midseason. But we've been over that a million times. I even said we weren't going to talk about it, and I can't believe we just friggin' brought it up. But there's so many free agents that the Ticats are going to have to try to re-sign, and a lot of them are looking for big pay raises. I just don't see the money being there, honestly. And Matthews going into next season, I wouldn't necessarily call him like a seasoned veteran, but he'll have had starting experience. He's going to start a playoff game, so maybe this is the trial by fire that he needs to become a good to maybe even great backup in the future. Maybe the seasoned veteran backups are already on the squad.
Yeah, exactly. I just don't see Austin spending money on a veteran quarterback. Like you said, there's so many free agents that have to be signed in the offseason. It's always great to have a veteran quarterback in case your starting quarterback goes down. But, you know, Matthews is going to have 4 or 5 games in the regular season, and then however many games he plays in the playoffs. So he'll have some experience, and maybe they ride with him as the backup quarterback.
We're going to find out. I would be surprised if they made a move to bring in a veteran, but that's just me, and you seem to feel the same way. So now we got a few questions about running backs and refereeing. Which one do you want to touch on first? You want to talk about running backs, or you want to talk about refereeing?
Let's go refereeing.
All right, so it seems that a lot of people were not too happy with the refereeing in yesterday's game. So Adam and Sean both asked not the same question, but they asked, we can cover them both. Adam asks, is the refereeing crew used in Sunday's game the worst in the league? And Sean wants to know what can be done to help fix the terrible refereeing epidemic in the league.
Well, what can be done is they got to put more money towards it. They got to get maybe make it a full-time gig. You know, CFL doesn't have a ton of money to throw around, but they need to invest more in the refereeing. They just need to try to improve it with more. You know, if they give it a full-time gig, then they're, you know, reffing all year round. Like, not all year round, but they're training and, you know, they get more. If this isn't a part-time job, maybe it improves. Maybe if they get paid more, maybe it improves. They just have to throw more money at it, I think, but I don't know if that's going to happen.
That's basically all you can do is better training and more training. These guys, this is a part-time job for them. They essentially you do this for however long the season goes. And why I'm no fan of the referees, and I think CFL officiating has been really bad for a very long time. We've seen bad officiating in a ton of football leagues, the NFL, the NCAA. There's just been bad officiating going around. This seems to be a problem in all football leagues, not just the CFL.
Yeah, it's seems to be somewhat of a epidemic, but you know, it's with the CFL, you know, it's a tough job. I don't know why anyone would want to do it. They get criticized so much and get paid little. So I agree that's been bad for years and years and years, but it's a really tough job.
So what did you think about the refereeing in yesterday's game?
I didn't think it was very good, but what can you say? You know, the pick sixes were brought back on questionable calls, and you know, it's just, you can't blame the referees for losses all the time, but no, they really put a dent in the Ticats' hopes yesterday.
My issue's not even on that particular play. It's the two challenges that Kent Austin needed to get calls reversed that were no-brainers. The pass interference on, I'm pretty sure it was Andy Fantuz, and the unnecessary roughness / face mask on Brandon Banks. The ball carrier, or the guy that the ball's intended to go to, that's where your vision is. And for both of those plays that were obvious from, I'm sitting 5 rows into the second deck of the stadium, and I can see that those were penalties. How can the guys who are 10, 15 feet away not see it? The Brandon Banks one to me was especially egregious because he had the ball and was running, so the focus is on him. You see the Ottawa defender take his hand and go across the helmet, touch the face mask. Yeah, he ended up dragging him down by the jersey. He didn't really bring him down by the mask, but that's a flag at any level of football. And why that needed to be challenged, I didn't even realize that could be challenged. When they said Ken Austin is challenging that a major foul caused the turnover, I was like, is this a makeup call because they realized that they botched this so bad? I've never heard that before. So if it's ever happened before, please, someone correct me and let me know. But that was the first I'd ever seen that. Those were the things that really stood out to me.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, the pass interference call was obvious as well. I mean, it was obvious that Fantuz was hit before the ball got there. So, yeah, the reffing was bad, but what else is new?
Let's talk about some running back stuff. So we got a few questions here about running backs. The first one comes from Adam. He sent in a ton of questions this week, all of which are really good. And he wants to know, why does Austin refuse to run the ball with Gable or run a wide receiver fade inside the 10-yard line?
Well, the running thing has been even back when he was offensive coordinator in Toronto. You know, one of his big downfalls was that he wouldn't run the ball. I believe he had Ricky Williams that year, and he wouldn't run the ball with Williams. So he's just not a big fan of the run game, I guess. You know, I'm a believer that you pass more in this league as well. I think sometimes the running game is, you know, overemphasized its importance, in my opinion. Sometimes it's just like it's not there. You know, they do the shotgun handoffs, and it just doesn't work. So I'm a believer that you have to pass more than you run, but I'm also a believer that you have to run more than he's been running the ball when you have a talented guy like CJ Gable back there. So especially when it gets to cold weather, I don't know why he does. You know, he just doesn't like to. He's just a pass first guy. So, and I'm not sure about the fades either. I never really noticed that, but maybe that's a good idea with you know, Bakari Grant being 6'4" and Fantuz being 6'4". You know, use those tall guys to go up and get the ball.
Yeah, Terrence Tolliver's tall too when he's out there. Terrence Tolliver's tall. That's a tongue twister. but he's a tall guy too. So when he's out there, throw him deep to him too. Yeah, it's the running the ball thing. I think as long as Ken Austin's head coach here, we're always going to be harping on him not running the football. He's an ex-quarterback. He puts his faith in the quarterbacks, and he likes to throw. It's just the way it is. A good mix of, say, 65 to 68% pass to 35 to 32% run would be fine with me. I think Gable needs to, if you're not going to use him in the running game, use him in the short passing game. He needs to get the ball in his hands between 15 and 18 times every single game. That is where you will get the most effect out of him. And yeah, I don't know why they don't run the ball in close. They have such a talented player in CJ Gable, and they just don't give him the ball. It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, we know that Dawson's really high on him, so maybe we'll see it the next game and in the playoffs that Gable gets a ton of touches, especially with the cold weather coming and already here pretty much.
So we have a question from Andrew about running backs as well, and he says, how can you run an offense with only 7 touches by your starting running back and do so over a QB that threw 2 red zone interceptions?
That's a good question. You know, if Claros is in there, I have no problem with him, you know, passing the ball as much as he did. But Matthews just isn't that guy. He's not Claros. He's gonna make mistakes like we saw last game. You know, those were 2 huge, huge interceptions that just really cost the team. So they just have to rely more on Gable to take the pressure off Matthews.
The 2 absolute worst places to throw an interception are in the end zone and inside your own 20-yard line, because those are taking points off the board in one instance and putting points on the board for the opposition team in the other. And most of Jeff Matthews' turnovers have been of those 2 varieties. I just said I don't understand why they don't use Gable more. I wish I could get in their heads and find out why they're not giving him the ball as much as they should. Again, like I said earlier, I gave him a pass on the BC game because of how out of hand that got early. But you're in a 9-point game and then a 6-point game and a 3-point game. There's no reason why you shouldn't be running the football, especially when they had the ball going into the wind, and it was a pretty heavy wind yesterday. That's the time when you feed the running back. Ottawa did it to perfection. They got William Powell the ball quite a bit. They were able to do what Hamilton couldn't, and like they ran a draw play on 2nd and 20 that picked up 22 yards.
Yeah.
And you can't tell me that William Powell, as good as he's looked, is anywhere at the back that CJ Gable is. So why not give him the ball? Why not feed him the rock? I know Ottawa has, especially entering this game, they had the league's best rush defense, but they had not faced CJ Gable this year. And CJ Gable is good enough to beat the best rush defense in the CFL. He had a couple good runs yesterday. Just it boggles the mind. It really does. So Sean asks, will we see CJ Gable used more next week, and why didn't we see more of him today? I know we pretty much just talked about this, but what do you think?
I think we will. I think that Austin's going to really reevaluate his game plan, and I think he's going to get many touches next week, whether it be running the ball or screen passes, that type of thing through the air. So yeah, I think that he's going to get a ton more touches, way more than 7.
I really hope so. But to answer the question of why we didn't see him used more against Ottawa on Sunday, the one thing I noticed is that the Ticats, when they had the wind, tended to run the up-tempo, no-huddle offense. I don't know if you noticed that as well. So yep. they were trying to make sure that Ottawa couldn't substitute. The problem was is they would start doing this with Gable on the sidelines, which means Gable couldn't come into the game. The second they bring Gable into the game, they slow things down. They allow Ottawa to get some substitutions in. They didn't want to do that. That's, I think, why you saw so many carries. I think Sinkfield had 4 carries, some pretty good carries too. But they were running this high-speed offense, and I think that's why he didn't get the ball as much as he should have. Now, I don't think if they would have put him in, he would have seen his touches double. Like, I don't think he was getting 14, 15 carries. Maybe he gets one or two more. But the reason we didn't see him as much is because I noticed they were running this fast-paced offense that didn't allow for him to get in the game. He was on the sidelines for the times when they were running it.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, Banks got a couple touches on the running game too, and he did pretty well. So, you know, there was some running plays in there. It wasn't just 7 touches for Gable. There was Sinkfield, and Banks had some touches. So I'm sure Gable's going to get more, but maybe we'll see more of the Sinkfield, Banks, you know, Banks with the reverses and stuff like that. So just running the ball more with, you know, whoever it is, Gable, Banks, Sinkfield, they all did a pretty good job. So just take the pressure off of Matthews more, and I'll be happy.
We got 3 more questions to go. This is a long question segment, maybe our longest ever. These all come from Adam on the 3 Down Nation comment section. The first one is, why does the CFL insist on going up against 8 NFL games at 1 p.m. on Sundays? If they have to play a game on Sundays because of TSN, why not start at 4 p.m. and only go up against 2 or 3 games?
You know, it's a question we've heard year after year after year. I don't know, maybe they're going to change their ideas of going on Sunday because of some of the ratings that have coming out this year. You know, usually the CFL does really well on Sundays, and in years past it doesn't seem to be that way this year, so maybe they change that up. But what are they going to do? You know, you go on Friday, that's pretty open, you know, there's not much going on sporting wise on Friday. You know, Saturday they can do it in the afternoon, but then you got hockey night in Canada, and we all know that hockey's the number one sport in Canada, and there's a lot of crossover. You know, the fans of the Oilers are fans of the Eskimos, you know, fans of the Flames are fans of the Stampeders, so you make a tough decision there. You know, do you play on Thursday? Well, then there's an NFL game on Thursday. You know, you play on Sunday, then there's 8 NFL. You know, it's tough for the CFL. You know, it's like, oh, why doesn't the CFL kowtow to all these other leagues? You know, CFL's so pathetic and no one watches it, so why would they put it up against something else? You know, just, it's getting tiring. You know, year after year we hear this question. So maybe it's a scheduling thing with the state stadiums. With Montreal, I know they can only play on Sundays because of the university team. So it's just tough, but I'm kind of sick of hearing this question year after year.
I don't like them playing on Sundays simply because I'm a football junkie, and I've said this many times before. I want to watch as many games as I can, so when the leagues are competing with each other, I have to click back and forth, and I don't really get to get into a flow of any game. So that's for me, that's a selfish personal reason. CFL games do well when they go up against NFL games on Sundays, so as much as I don't like it, there's a financial reason for doing it. Sundays people see as football day. It's been that way for a long time. Yeah, I won't go as far as saying I'm sick of hearing the question. You seem to get pretty angry about that, but fair enough. Like, it is something we hear all the time, but it's just the way it is. Like you said, stadium issues with Montreal and other teams, and the ratings do well on Sundays, even going up against NFL games. So it's just the way it is, and I guess we're just going to have to put up with it.
And by no means it was a shot at the person asking the question. I mean, it's a valid question. It just seems to be hammered. It just seems to be asked year after year after year. And I just think the CFL is a reason for it. I'm not sure what it is, but maybe it'll change in the future.
2 more to go, and then we can call it a day. So, this is a pretty simple one. Who do you guys predict will finish the season with more receiving yards and touchdowns, Tasker or Sinkfield? Currently, Sinkfield has 12 more yards, and both have 6 touchdowns.
I'm going to go with Tasker. I just think that Matthews relies on Tasker more than he does Sinkfield. I think he's the go-to guy, so I'm going to go with Tasker.
Tasker for both touchdowns and receiving yards?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to split my vote. I'm going to go Sinkfield for receiving yards and Tasker for touchdowns because I think Terrell Sinkfield is going to bust a big one against Ottawa. He nearly did it against Ottawa this week. He got tackled by the ankles, and if he squirts out of that tackle, he goes the distance for a touchdown. I think he's going to do that against Ottawa. I think he's going to take a 5-yard slant route, make a guy miss, and go to the house. So I'm going to say Sinkfield gets the team lead for receiving yards, but I'm going to say Tasker catches 2 TDs against Ottawa, short ones, like inside the 10 to 15 yard line, and Tasker ends up leading the team in touchdown catches. Final question of the day, and we're leaving on a bit of a funny question. So a little lightheartedness to end the day after what has been a very long episode of mostly us being angry. So let's get out of here on something a little lighthearted. And Adam ends off asking, when will the Ticats learn that they shouldn't give away free mini football? balls. They constantly get thrown on the field. Stick with the t-shirts or towels. I don't know if you noticed, but at the game, they handed out mini footballs to everybody. And late in the game, after I'm not sure what play it was, it might have been the interception guy got called back for a touchdown. I'm pretty sure that's what it was. The Brandon Stewart TD that called back. People started throwing the mini footballs onto the field. And Mike Neighbors, I think it's Mike Neighbors. No, Jim Neighbors was the actor. So yeah, it's Mike Neighbors, who's the PA guy at Tim Hortons Field, came on and said, please do not throw the footballs onto the field. You can be kicked out and you could be banned from the facility and have your season tickets revoked. And the team can get fined and all that stuff. And it didn't stop it. And I believe it was Labor Day last year where they handed out mini footballs and they got tossed onto the field too. I think it was after Pecari Grant's first ever touchdown at Tim Hortons Field. So yeah, it's kind of funny, and it's you shouldn't throw things on the field. I think we can all agree on that. But yeah, maybe sticking to the t-shirts or the rally towels or whatever would be a good thing going forward.
Yeah, it's probably a good idea. I mean, yeah, they're mini footballs. You're not going to hurt anyone with those. They're, you know, pretty soft, and you know, they're not throwing batteries or anything like they did at Mike O'Shea back in the day. But yeah, it's probably a better idea just to give out the t-shirts or something that can't be hurled on the field.
Hamilton people are, I'm going to try to put this nicely, I'm not going to say cheap, but we do like our freebies here. I remember years ago, the Ticats would do a season seat holder party at the beginning of the year where you could go pick up your seats, and they would have free Swiss Chalet. And the lineup to get the free Swiss Chalet was longer than the lineup to get tickets. Because it's like, free chicken? Yeah, I'm going for the free chicken. I'm almost positive that there were people who didn't get season seats that simply showed up just to get the free chicken. Yeah. And then would just leave.
Free chicken.
Yeah, hey, I'm not going to spit in someone's face or offer me a free piece of chicken. I'll never do that. Free food of any kind, I'm not saying no to. And then last year in the final game, this was Fan Appreciation Day at the stadium. So in the final game last year against Montreal was sort of the same thing. They gave everyone these t-shirts. Some of them, it was the Oski Wee Wee chant, and some of them, everyone got, each section got different ones. So there was, I think, four or five different t-shirts out there. And you don't see those getting thrown out because who's going to throw away a free t-shirt? But footballs, mini footballs, yeah, those are just asking to get tossed. So yeah, maybe sticking with the rally towels is a better idea.
Yeah, definitely a better idea.
So don't forget, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. If you want to have your questions read on the show and answered by Mike and myself, like hopefully not as many as we got this week, because Jesus, that was long. You can hit us up on Twitter. Mike, give him your Twitter handle, buddy.
Mike_Ticats.
And I'm JoshSmith_82. And feel free to post your questions in the comments section of 3Down Nation. We got a lot of those this week. So for Podski Wee Wee this week, I am Josh Smith.
I'm Mike Graham. Eat 'em raw.